William Shakespeare, the most famous author of all time, writer of 37 plays, and why we are here today. But what if I told you Shakespeare never wrote a single word?
That's what a new film, Anonymous, says, but it's not the first time the question has been asked. Was the author of the Shakespearean plays actually William Shakespeare? I had a chance to see the film on Friday, and Rhonda didn't know that I had seen the film, and she said, what about this? Was Shakespeare Shakespeare question? Should we do that? And I said, well, yeah, that might be kind of fun to do. And I had just seen the film, and I think the film is a beautiful film to watch, but it's got more than a few inaccuracies. And why are we obsessed with this question so many generations later? Could William Shakespeare actually have written the plays that he did? And the sonnets, was he indeed a genius? And how could he have been? Because he wasn't a member of the court. He wasn't highly educated, etc. Well, we're going to entertain the question this hour, and I hope that some of you listening have seen the film, because it could be an influential film in that there are study guides that the film's producers are putting together to distribute to classrooms so that people can ask children if indeed they think Shakespeare was Shakespeare. So they may be taking young minds and slanting them to something that may indeed just be conspiracy theories. Our guest this hour has written an interesting piece on Huffington Post. Shakespeare is Shakespeare, so says Jonathan Hobrosh. He teaches English at Pace University and works at Huffington Post. He received his MFA in creative writing from Texas State University. He lives in New York City, where he's working on several book-length projects. He enjoys, his bio says, coffee, walking, history, and literature. Our kind of guy. And he writes in his piece, he wrote this blog on the heels of the new Shakespeare movie Anonymous, a historically inaccurate film containing at least five conspiracy theories. The protagonist is Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford, praised by literary birthers as the true author of Shakespeare's work. The Oxfordian theory has continued to be a popular theory, however easily dismissed. And he says, in an effort to do my academic duty to save young minds from going astray, he presents to us 10 of the most obvious reasons that William Shakespeare is the author of the works of William Shakespeare. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Oh, you have a Shakespearean voice.
No, it's just deep. I'm a tall person.
You're a tall person who likes coffee. Well, I saw the film just by chance because my husband and I can't agree on a lot of films. So he said, how about Anonymous? And I said, you know, come on, Shakespeare was Shakespeare. But I agreed to go. And it's a beautiful film in many
ways. Yeah, I agree.
Isn't it? It's really beautiful. But it's so wildly off historically and entertaining this whole question. And they got these really top-notch actors. Do they all sort of buy into this conspiracy theory? People like Vanessa Redgrave?
Well, I mean, I haven't done too much research on that part, but the little that I've read, it sounded like this is what they were talking about while they were producing this film. And if they weren't convinced, if they didn't believe it going in, it sounded like that they believed it by the end of it. And the thing is with this play, basically when I was watching it, I went in hoping to enjoy it, despite the fact that I know it was going to contain this conspiracy theory.
Right.
And some of my friends that also teach, they were able to laugh at it, but maybe I took it a little too seriously, and I just started getting upset. I just started focusing on everybody around me, wondering, basically assuming that at least one person in this audience was going to leave thoroughly convinced. And, I mean, just convincing one person of something that just isn't true is, it's almost like a crime to me. But but the thing is, the argument is kind of weakened also by these historical inaccuracies in the film, so it really doesn't do as much harm as it could have been. could have done.
Right. Well, and then there's this educational push into schools. There's an educational company preparing study guides for educators on the authorship question. As with some previous films, I don't have a problem with Roland Emmerich drinking the Kool-Aid, said Columbia's Shapiro, but when he serves it to kids in paper cups, I do. They're actually promoting this whole idea, which is a lot of hooey in schools?
Yeah, I heard about that, too. I think the greatest damage it does is that it's focusing the students. It's basically focusing on the authorship question rather than focusing on his work, which is a lot more important.
Mm-hmm. So for those who have not seen the film and who are not familiar with this conspiracy theory, tell us about Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford.
Okay, well, there's been a lot of different conspiracy theories. This Earl of Oxford theory started in 1920 by a guy, his last name, well, he pronounced his last name Loney, but it's spelled Looney. Yeah, some people make fun of that name.
But, what? Really?
Yeah. And... And basically, they recognized the Earl of Oxford as Shakespeare because the Earl was a nobleman that was known to have written plays. For instance, Francis Mears writes a discourse in 1598. I mention it in my 5 points. Well, one of the people mentioned in this discourse, when he enumerates the great writers of the English language, in the best for comedy section, he mentions the Earl of Oxford. He was, and thus being a nobleman, he would have had knowledge of the court, knowledge of Latin. Oxford was known as being an enthusiast for Italy. The Oxfordians also bring up a lot of stuff that really, it's just kind of like they're just picking at things. For instance, they try to say that you can find the Oxford's life within Shakespeare's plays. Well, there's a lot of Shakespeare plays, there's a lot of characters, there's a lot of events going on, so it's very easy to nitpick at little things.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is they like to, one of the things I heard was that, what was it? Gabriel Harvey, who's an intellectual thinker during that time, referred to Oxford by a Latin name called Vultus Tella Vibrat. And the translation the Oxfordians like to use is Will shakes spears, as like a code. But Latin's like one of those languages where, like, one word can mean so many different things. Like, really, that word is probably closer to, like, you know, the appearance of brandishing weapons or something like that. It's not a specific spear. So basically what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of nitpicking and trying to really, like, you know, pull things towards their argument.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that you write at number one as the list of reasons that it could not have been this guy is that he died in 1604, and a lot of plays were written after 1604 in collaboration with some other people.
Yeah, John Fletcher is the main one. And there's also a guy named Wilkins. But, we know for sure Oxford died in 1604. There's no question about that. The plays afterwards fit that time period as far as plays written after 1604. King James became king just before that. The style of the plays changed. This also kind of goes into my second point. And they can be pretty much easily dated, not exactly, but for that time period. Because, for instance, a lot of these later plays were designed to be played indoors. There's a theater called the Blackfriars Theater. It was an indoor theater. Globe was an outdoor theater. And the musical instruments used during these plays would have been different. You have solemn music in these later plays, whereas before, in these outdoor theaters, you had trumpets and drums, loud instruments. You have... You have much more dancing in these later plays because that's what was popular at that time. You have what's called a mask. You have a lot of mask-like dancing in these later plays. You have less classical rhetoric. You have less chronicle histories, and the histories that you do have are generally further back in the past. They're like going to pre-Christian times. The one history play that does occur there, I mean, later on, is Henry VIII. The Globe actually burned down during the first staging. Henry VIII was actually had a different name at that time. It wasn't called Henry VIII. It was called All's Well. And a lot of the comedies later on are tragic comedies rather than romance comedies.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a few of the differences.
And Richard III, which figures prominently in this film, they got the date on when this was written by Shakespeare all mixed up in this film.
Yeah, that was actually supposed to be Richard II during that Essex Rebellion, because Richard II was seen as a weak king that needed to be replaced. So it was Richard II that was staged. Richard III was staged way earlier. And they did this for creative license, so they could make fun of the younger Cecil, Robert Cecil, who's a hunchback in this film. I'm not sure if he was in real life or not, but and that's another inaccuracy. They had something called the Master of the Revels, which censored plays. And there's clearly no censorship before the plays are staged in this. They have William Cecil and later Robert Cecil both mocked on the stage, which wouldn't have been allowed.
The other thing that they do is make real fun of William Shakespeare, who's an absolute buffoon in this. And this has been part of the whole Shakespeare couldn't possibly have been Shakespeare, all the books that have been written over the centuries, because he was not a highly educated man.
Yeah, and they I think they also have him murdering Marlowe,
right?
Who should have been dead 5 years previously.
Right.
Also, Oxford's wife should have been dead like in the late 1580s. They make him a buffoon. The other thing that's kind of funny to me is that he can read exceptionally well. He's reading no problem reading, but he apparently can't write.
Right.
It's rather insulting for anybody that really loves William Shakespeare, even though we don't have that much as far as we don't know that much about his personality.
Mm-hmm. Why have these theories, conspiracy theories, occupied not just 2011, but they've been going on for hundreds of years? What's that all about?
Well, I mean, they're kind of relatively recent. Like, I think the first conspiracy theory involving Shakespeare was in the early 1800s, I think. And I think that was with Francis Bacon. The thing with the Shakespeare conspiracy is if Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare, if he had been like John Webster, one of his contemporary playwrights who was very good, but definitely not at Shakespeare's level, we probably wouldn't even have this much energy devoted to it. The thing is, with a lot of these conspiracies, imagine the person that's able to come up with this conspiracy theory and prove it as being true. I mean, that person becomes extremely influential and extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it might be that. Part of it's also, it's kind of fun to be a part of a conspiracy, because when you're a part of the conspiracy, you're one of the limited few who know, and then you feel like you're in some intellectual superior position. I'll give you a little secret. When I was younger, like 18 or 19, I actually thought this Oxford theory was true.
You did?
Yeah, and I read it in, it's a book by Michael Hart. It's called The 100, like the 100 most influential people in human history or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And which is a good book despite that. And I read it. It was very convincing, but I also wasn't as well read in Shakespeare at that time as I am now.
Right.
I don't remember exactly what moved me away from it. I think it was just really gradual realization, or maybe it was just sudden realization, but the Oxford theory was just not important enough to me to actually like make me notice that it went away.
Mm-hmm. And then they do in the film this elaborate, and you would have to believe they're taking great license with history, about what was going on in the court with Edward and Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah,
and
definitely.
Whether or
yeah.
not he was her son, and then there were a whole series of ancestral things going on. And, I mean, how much of that was just what the theater, making up the story as you go along to make for a good movie?
Yeah, I don't know if they felt like they had to do that in order to get people to watch it or not. I mean, those are all theories. Those are all theories created by people that believe that the Earl of Oxford is the Earl of Oxford. And James Shapiro's book, Contested Will, he brings up basically how this has evolved. They're trying to figure out reasons why to make Oxford more important, reasons why he might want to hide his identity, and so on. Another thing with the play, I mean with the movie as well, is the go-between between this Shakespeare and Earl of Oxford is Ben Jonson. And Ben Jonson, he was born in 1572 and he died in 1637, and Ben Jonson appears older for some reason than Shakespeare, but he's the go-between in this. Okay, the reason why those dates are important is Ben Jonson's alive way after both Queen Elizabeth is dead and Oxford is dead, and way after Shakespeare is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this movie, there is no reason for him to keep this secret, and you would think it would let out anyway.
Right.
I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
There's an understatement. The whole thing is kind of wacky, but it's amusing. As long as it's not damaging, there's something to the film. It's pretty. It's a real pretty film. With some good performances. At any rate, let's take your phone calls and your emails. Our guest this hour is Jonathan Hobrosh, professor of English at Pace University. We're talking about the new film Anonymous, which claims that Edward de Vere is the true author of Shakespeare's plays. It couldn't possibly be Shakespeare. Our guest this hour has written a piece saying that Shakespeare is Shakespeare, and he gives us 10 of the most obvious reasons that William Shakespeare is the author of the works that have his name. So here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm hopeful. I know the movie just came out, but it's not as though these ideas haven't been floating around, and I'm sure that many of you have read some books. There have been quite a few of them recently that question whether or not Shakespeare could possibly have written the plays by Shakespeare or the poems. So we'll go to you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls. Tom in Burlington, hi.
Are you there?
Yeah, we're here, Tom. Go ahead.
There's just a couple things I wanted to point out. One of the interesting things about Shakespeare that I found is I wrote a musical with a man named Warren Casey who wrote Grease, the musical Grease, and then we wrote another musical together. But one of the things he pointed out to me was that Shakespeare, always his tragic hero, he always did it to himself. No one else did it to him, but he did it to himself. And anyway, the thing with Shakespeare, when I saw this the musical Amadeus, and that was the conflict between Salieri and Mozart, and they made Mozart look so terrible in that movie that I was really very, very depressed. Now I haven't seen this movie, but to take a hero that you like Shakespeare and denigrate him that way, it really turns people off.
Professor Hobrosh.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I never saw the musical Amadeus. I saw the movie. I don't know if you're talking about the same thing. I don't like how Mozart's portrayed in that as well. It was very upsetting. Like I said earlier, I went in the movie kind of hoping to enjoy it, and I was upset not just because how I thought this would actually, you know, brainwash other people, but also I was really upset of how they portrayed William Shakespeare as a person.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even think of the words to even describe my anger about that. He's an illiterate actor that ends up murdering somebody that comes off as a horrible human being who's, you know, taking somebody else's glory and parading it around. I mean, he's probably the most dislikable person you could possibly find.
Yeah. I know.
William Shakespeare.
Yeah. It kind of begs the question, our need to know and why we need to know, or if we need to know, the person behind the music or the person behind the writing. No doubt, he was an incredible genius. I mean, look at how long his words have lived, and they're repeated and they're performed, and he informs our sorrow and our happiness and all of that. He's just a genius. So do we have to know about him? Can't we just leave it that we don't know very much about him, and that's okay, but here are these words?
Well, I mean, obviously that's okay, but at the same time, I think... I'll phrase it like this. I think it's nice to know. And I think it's also very important as well that, you know, Shakespeare is defended as Shakespeare if he is, in fact, Shakespeare. To supplant him with a noble, like, that doesn't have even strong claims to be Shakespeare, I mean, for the first part, one of the wonderful things about Shakespeare is that he came from a humble background.
Yes.
He didn't go to college.
Right.
He probably went to grammar school. And he learned his Latin there. We don't have proof of it, but it is very likely, more likely than not, that he went to a grammar school. It's not unusual either. Ben Jonson, I bring this up in my point. I think this is important to say. Ben Jonson also went to a grammar school. He didn't go to college. Ben Jonson, despite that, became one of the top classical scholars of the time. So much so that he was able to announce in a poem that that Shakespeare's Greek and Latin were not that great. And he ended up becoming a poet laureate of England.
Mm-hmm.
And he may have arguably been more popular than Shakespeare in that time, but he came from the same humble background. His father was a bricklayer. His father might not have been literate. We don't think Shakespeare's father was literate either.
So how much of this conspiracy theory is fueled by this upper crust idea that you can't possibly write anything as beautiful, as moving as this unless you are in the upper class?
Well, I think that's a lot of it. And again, the Ben Jonson example, I think, kind of dismisses that as an absolute. That's probably the main part. I don't really know what the true motives are behind this at all.
An email from John: I share the professor's fear that this movie will spread misinformation about Shakespeare. Many, many people will take what they see on screen as factual. Just look at how Oliver Stone's movie JFK gave an impressive veneer of credibility to the utterly debunked magic bullet theory.
Yeah, okay, here's my response to that. Obviously, this is going to do at least some of that damage. Again, I think the fact that there's so many conspiracy theories in this movie and so many historical inaccuracies that it comes off not as believable as it could have been. Now, if the Shakespeare part is going to be believed, from this movie, then, are there going to be people thinking that Queen Elizabeth had these affairs, had an incestuous affair that Marlowe's escaped his death just to be killed again by Shakespeare, and so on.
Right. You have to take in the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot to take in,
yeah.
Allison in Plum Lake. Hi, Allison.
Hi. I'm an ancestor of, supposedly, Shakespeare's an ancestor of mine. I'm related to his eldest daughter, Suzanne, because I understand his some of his other children died. But anyway, I have studied Shakespeare's work. I have seen the film. I literally fell asleep twice.
Oh.
I thought it was extremely poorly done, very hard to follow, very grainy actual film stock and cinematography. I think one of the issues that's an issue with Shakespeare's legacy is, first of all, he was a genius and people can be jealous of geniuses. He was also a man who grew up in a family where his father married a woman who had a very exceptional family. The family had land. The woman, his mother's family had land. His father did not. So his father spent a lot of the money poorly, made bad decisions. And so William Shakespeare may have been a Catholic. Some of this could be Catholic Protestant bias. Some of this could be lower class, high class bias. But I believe that he was the writer of the things that he was the writer of, that he was working very hard to make his family meaningful, to give his family prominence. And this entire thing, unintellectual in how it's been approached, that people don't question things, put out there as something that's true when it's really just an idea. But the thing is, too, when someone writes a book, it's a book. When someone makes a film, it's a film. They have a right to make a piece of art that says what it says. And so I look at it as, okay, that's your picture, that's your view, that's what you think, but thank you for sharing. It's not true.
Professor Obrush.
Excellent comment. I think you're absolutely right about people being jealous of his genius. Generally, if anybody is on top, for instance, many of you are from Wisconsin. Green Bay Packers haven't lost a game yet.
Thank you for reminding us.
I'm originally from Dallas, so I'm a Cowboys fan. But anyway, so like, you know, people get jealous if of the person at the top. They generally want whoever's at the top to fall at some point. The other thing that you brought up that's actually interesting, too, is about Shakespeare's family. It's not like he was a peasant. His father was a glover. It was something that made money. He made very ornate gloves. We have some pictures of gloves that we think that John Shakespeare, William's father, had made. He did marry, I think, Mary Arden. The father applied for a coat of arms. William Shakespeare got the coat of arms. William Shakespeare at one point bought one of the largest, if not the largest, houses in Stratford. He bought the Blackfriars Gatehouse. One can suppose, like, had Shakespeare lived longer, I wonder where his ambition could have gone. I mean, not just writing. I think maybe he might have been, for the most part, finished with writing. I don't know. People may disagree with me there. I think his style for the time might have been going a little bit out of fashion, and that might have been why he was having to collaborate with Fletcher, and Fletcher's style was really in at that time. But I think one reason Shakespeare writes a lot about aristocrats and nobles is I think somewhere deep down inside, he wanted to move upwards. He seemed like someone that was trying to get money in a profession where people were like, where writers were spending years in debtor's prison, getting arrested, getting killed, not being able to get married. Shakespeare was very stable. And I think this aristocratic mindset, I think part of it kind of got to him. But that would probably be the closest link I would link Shakespeare to being noble. It's just like the wish to aspire to a higher place.
How could his style at that time have been going out of fashion when he has never gone out of fashion?
Well, he's never gone. I mean, the thing is, there's been times where he's been more popular than others. There's a, I think it was in the, right at the end of the 1600s or 1700s, where he wasn't as popular as he was today. The thing is, picture having lived back then, or picture like some kind of extremely famous band like the Beatles, like right now. If the Beatles had kept playing for longer and longer and longer, despite how great that they were, at some point you'd want to hear somebody different. It's Fletcher's style was different because he liked the spring like surprises, and there was a tempo that was going up and down, up and down. It was a lot more superficial too, but it was also something people wanted to see. Shakespeare was rarely superficial. And he could have probably, like, you know, been malleable enough to fit that style, but he might not have liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't know. I mean, nevertheless, he was in semi-retirement, by around, I guess, 1609 or 1610.
Thank you, Allison. Delightful to hear from you. It was a great call. Mary,
thank you.
Mary in Madison. Hi.
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 I wanted to say, I haven't seen the film, but there is a theory that is not well known that the plays were written by Mary Sidney Herbert, who was the sister of the poet Philip Sidney. She's Countess of Pembroke. She had a library that gave her access to not just the ability to write. We know she wrote because she wrote translations, which were allowed for women, but women were not allowed to write this kind of play. And she had a library that had the materials that have the stories that Shakespeare's plays are modeled on, and it would have been very hard to get to those materials because there were no public libraries. So while Shakespeare might have had the verbal skill, he didn't have access to some of the information she did. And I read this book 3 years ago. There are several things. The book is called Sweet Swan of Avon by Robin Williams, not the actor, but a woman. And it shows some of the most interesting things are a lot of the images, like the majority of images, are feminine images. Sleep that knitteth up the raveled sleeve of care. We laugh to see the sails conceive and grow big-bellied with the wanton wind. There are a tremendous number of images that come out of very domestic life in that, and it's odd that a man would do that. It also, the plays follow her events. They get light when her life is well, and they get dark when her life is dark. And there's the poem, To the Dark Lady, which has puzzled people about Shakespeare because it sounds like he's talking about a homosexual lover. But if it was written by a woman, and at that time Mary was in a love triangle with a dark-haired woman, then it makes sense.
Are you familiar with Mary Sidney Herbert?
No, I haven't read that book, so I can't comment on that part so much, but I'll look into it. But, however, I can comment on some of the things that you said. You're right. Women generally didn't write plays. There was a one woman playwright. I think her last name was Carrie, but obviously I think it was anonymous. When I forgot her first name, Elizabeth maybe. Sidney, the brother of Mary Sidney that you mentioned. He was probably the great poet before Shakespeare and Edmund Spenser and Christopher Marlowe. So she definitely has some of that blood in her. The argument with the books, that can kind of be dismissed because London had a lot of bookstores during that time. Shakespeare, if a genius, was a great reader. He could have perused the books. I'm pretty sure the companies which made a lot of money probably took in a whole bunch of books. They would have bought books just for the specific reason for getting a play written. Not only that, another good example is a playwright named Thomas Dekker. Thomas Dekker, he spent 7 years in debtor's prison. And he didn't have like a good education either. Because he was in debtor's prison, he obviously didn't have the money to get the books. Yet he was cranking out at times about 11 plays a year. His most famous one is Shoemaker's Holiday, which is made fun of in the Anonymous movie as a failure, but it was actually a big success. But so Dekker would have had to have books to come up with the plots for like a lot of his movies. So he was able to get a hold of books some way. And Shakespeare probably got a hold of books in a similar fashion. Mm. However they did, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mary, you were convinced, though, after reading this book, Sweet Swan?
I was convinced that it's an interesting hypothesis. We'll
right.
never know.
Right, yes.
But I agree with you that the important thing is the plays, not who wrote them. But what's interesting, and friends of mine for 3 years have been doing this, is to see the plays and say, now, how does this look different if it was written by a woman? For example, The Taming of the Shrew. And another element is that Shakespeare's women, with a few exceptions like Desdemona, are strong characters, and that was not all that common at that time.
That's an interesting way to see a play then, yeah. Thank you, Mary, very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Shakespeare this hour of the program, and many of us have seen the new film Anonymous, which claims that Shakespeare was not Shakespeare, that he was a buffoon, and he could read, but he couldn't write. And the actual genius behind all of the plays and sonnets was Edward de Vere. And our guest is debunking that, saying that indeed Shakespeare was Shakespeare. Jonathan Hobrosh, professor of English at Pace University, is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your calls, Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Marvelous topic. Excellent guest.
Thanks.
I have difficulty with the idea that you need a sophisticated aristocrat to generate these marvelous plays with the unique insight into humanity. This is not based upon anything aside from actually attending a few of these plays, but I tend to think of Shakespeare as being a member of this highly competitive commercial theater company that has to satisfy, you know, state patrons and sometime at the same time a very, very rowdy and demanding audience which might haul the actors from the stage if they don't perform at an adequate level. So it was a very demanding, and so they would have been into providing what both audiences wanted. You don't need to invoke a lord to do that. They had someone who knew how to act and could write and plagiarize. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Yeah, that was great. Much more eloquent than I could state it.
Frank is a great, great caller. Always eloquent. The other thing that was strange about the film was using the words to get your way politically, to incite an audience to take political action. Was there any history of Shakespeare doing that or any other playwrights doing that at that time?
Well, the only time that I can think of where a play was done for that purpose, and they get it half right in the movie, and I mentioned it earlier, is when the movie it's Richard III, in real life it was Richard II.
Right.
The Earl of Essex wanted Richard II to be staged to get London in this mood for his rebellion, and the company initially said like, oh, that play's like a few years old, and then they gave them more money and then convinced them. Of course, it didn't help. The rebellion failed just like it did in the movie. The other playwrights, I mean, there were plays written to, like, fit, you know, the mood of the country, for instance, like, you know, if relations were in a certain way regarding Spain, like, you know, there may be more plays written about Spain. Like, for instance, the Spanish Tragedy was written in or around the time of the Spanish Armada. Thomas Kidd wrote the Spanish Tragedy. And then later on, there's the proposed marriages between Prince Charles, who becomes King Charles I, and possibly with the Queen of Spain. I think he actually, a princess of Spain, I think he actually marries her. I'm not completely sure. But then you start having more plays involving Spain. So it's not quite like the way the movie states makes it out to be.
Joy in Madison. Hi, Joy.
Hi, good morning. Very interesting show. I also fell asleep at only once, and I also saw it Friday evening.
Oh, did you?
Yes. But, you know, I thought it was beautiful in terms of the filming of it. I did find the flashbacks and flash forwards, whatever you call them, to be kind of confusing after a while. But I guess my take on the whole thing is that I'm not such a huge fan of Shakespeare that I don't find this more interesting than painful. I don't find it particularly painful at all. The possibility that Oxford could be the one that wrote the plays, I find it kind of an interesting tragedy in and of itself if such a thing had happened, that he had to hide his own talent. And I do really appreciate the woman who called and talked about the Sweet Swan book, because that sounds very interesting. And I guess my bottom line on this is that I hate to see the movie debunked, because I think it's a very interesting, opens up some interesting avenues for thought and investigation, as that woman so beautifully said, that we perhaps will never know. But it's interesting to go into the bigger trends and the things that might imply that something else could have happened. And I don't think he was a buffoon. I think he was a bumpkin, personally. I didn't think he was portrayed as a buffoon, but that's my thought.
All right. Thank you very much, Joy. What about you, Professor? Do you think that people should see this, or would you like it just to go away?
I think it's important to see it, just like, especially once you go in with, like, the argument that the authorship could be true or not. I mean, I think the one thing that the one benefit this movie could show, it might actually, like, make it easier to disprove the Earl of Oxford, just because it's enclosed in this kind of absurd movie, at least historically absurd. It is beautiful. Actually, one thing I wanted to point out really quick, that when the caller was speaking, I thought about this. The one part I do like is how they show the interaction between the stage and the audience. Do you remember that part? It's during Henry V, and he's giving his St. Crispin speech, and he's addressing the audience as if the audience are his soldiers.
Yes.
And he leans over and he puts his arm out, and everybody starts grabbing his arm. And he gets the whole crowd engaged, and they start cheering, and they all want to kill the French.
Mm-hmm.
I like that part. I like some of those kind of touches. The only part of the whole movie that really upsets me are all these conspiracy theories and historical inaccuracies.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie is a beautiful movie, and I think one can go into that or go into Shakespeare and, you know, be okay whether or not it's going to be the author is Shakespeare or whether it's Oxford. If for some reason, and I don't think this will ever happen, that Oxford is somehow proven to be Shakespeare, it's not going to make me like his work any less.
Right. What about the whole idea that being a poet, being an accomplished writer, was something that was deeply frowned upon in Elizabeth's court.
I don't think being a poet was, I mean, being a playwright probably was, but being a poet wasn't necessarily frowned upon. For instance, one of your previous callers brought up Mary Sidney. Her brother, Sir Philip Sidney, who was a courtier, Sir Walter Raleigh, another courtier, they openly wrote poetry. And they wrote poetry to each other, and they had poems dedicated to them. Sir Philip Sidney is one of the great muses of the age. Edmund Spenser dedicates work to him. Other poets dedicate work to him. I think Raleigh's had work dedicated to him. So writing poetry isn't frowned upon. Here's another example of that. When William Shakespeare came out with Venus and Adonis, which in the movie they have a Venus and Adonis coming out right before Elizabeth dies. It actually came out around like 1594, and it kind of established his reputation as a great writer. That's another historical inaccuracy. But Venus and Adonis, he proudly puts his name there, and he dedicates it to Southampton. And then he writes another poem after that and dedicates it to Southampton.
Hmm.
But as far as playwrights go, that was a different kind of art. It wasn't looked upon as highly as the poems like Venus and Adonis or the Rape of Lucrece.
Mm-hmm. Joy, thank you. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think it's extremely important to know who writes works. I mean, that we know certain people wrote the Synoptic Gospels, that we know Leonardo da Vinci did this work of art or that work of art. I think authorship's extremely important. I'm also wondering basic questions, because it helps us understand the work if we understand the artist. The basic questions of signature variants of the historical William Shakespeare. I understand people sign their names differently, but 6 or 7 variations, the lack of books in his Stratford home at his death, the inconsistencies of his knowledge base of, I mean, this theory of Looney, of the Earl of Oxford, I guess it's gotten such truck because it just fits like a glove, I suppose, with Earl of Oxford and his background and his understanding of court manners and falconry and medicine and geography and weaponry and on, but the inconsistencies of the historical William Shakespeare, at his death, no celebrations at court, his body not buried in Westminster. I guess with such a huge personage that we're talking about, the inconsistencies don't add up to me.
Okay. Okay, where do I start here? With the handwriting. Shakespeare, like, if you look at it, we don't have any of his original manuscripts, but we have copies of his manuscripts, and there's, he generally will spell a word different times, even within, like, you know, on the same page. I mean, that's not unusual. We talked about the books earlier, like, if Thomas Dekker could somehow get books despite being someone in debtor's prison, then Shakespeare could probably get books. What was the last part of your statement?
Well, why doesn't he have some kind of a library in his Stratford home upon his death? Why isn't there some kind of a library there, as he's there for years in his retirement? He certainly had the means to have a library. I mean,
true. I mean, it's just one of the things that we don't know. I mean, on his will, everything wasn't listed. I mean, like, if we took everything from his will and put it into his house, he would have a pretty sparse house.
Right.
For some reason or another, we don't. I mean, I don't know if it was just something that was assumed to be inherited with the house, or what.
Hmm.
So I mean, that's a possibility. There was a last something you mentioned after this that seemed important.
Well, the understanding of the courtly manners, the understanding of falconry.
Yeah, okay. Let's get that. We're running out of time.
Okay, sorry about that. Well, the thing is, there's a scholar, and I mentioned her in my article. Her name is, where is it? St. Clair Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, Muriel St. Clair Byrne. And she enumerates all of Shakespeare's mistakes involving court life. And she also notices that he increases his knowledge as he writes plays, like he's slowly learning it. But he gets the etiquette and ceremonial, like, complications, like, wrong. They're not reflected properly, or they're like a homelier version of court life.
And we thank you very much. It's been really a fun hour and interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Our guest this hour, Professor Jonathan Hobrosh. He's a professor of English at Pace University, and you can find his piece on Huffington Post, Shakespeare is Shakespeare, posted on 11/3/11 at 10:33 a.m. Eastern Time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We're with you tomorrow, looking at poverty in Milwaukee tomorrow at 9:00.